Okay, my first poem this evening is about myself and my mother. I used to bring my mother to Inishmore every year, and we'd go out on the ferry, and she just loved it so much. And anyway, after this particular trip, she never came on a trip anywhere with me again. And you would find out, not because she died, but she did some while later, but at this particular... So anyway, I'll just read the poem. It's called... One woman's sardines is another's poison. The Russell Dean to Kilrona ferry rolls with the swell. Mum delighted sways with the waves. Her lunchbox, tea flask, and half wagon spread on the table. What a wonderful manifestation of nature. God's powerful hand rocking us like a cradle. A sandwich, she offered. No, thank you. Sardines, whiskey, and diesel fumes mingle with the pink. Stale air of the galley. My stomach churns. Hot waves engulf my head. I run on deck, cling to the railing, and drenched in sea spray, my stomach settles. Next day, Mum's fragile feet negotiate the karst pathway to the Mangus. She stops frequently to catch her breath. Imagine this fort was built 5,000 years ago by our Druid ancestors to worship their sun god. Waving my hand along the thin, the navy line of the horizon, they saw as we do now the creamy sun fall, turn red, and for a fleeting moment set the sea ablaze before disappearing into the grey Atlantic. I say, as they made their sacrifices, these same waves beat and sculpted this cliff face. In eroding sea stacks and blowholes, magnificent. Shaking her head, sadly, anxiously, why do you bring me to these queer lonely places, dangerous places, where grey stones piled high on each other, where any sort of a villain could lurk and drop dead bodies over the sheer cliff into the wild sea, never to be heard of again. This next poem is inspired by a photo that a woman that we don't know saw of herself many, many years before that. Sculpted by nuns, she sits prim on the wall outside the boarding school, arms folded, knees together, her Child of Mary medal on a blue ribbon, a smile that knows the seven virtues, the deadly sins. 2 years later, London, 1969, for the Stones concert in Hyde Park, a little Greek god takes seat in the tabernacle of her womb. And as she listens to King Crimson's Schizoid Man and the Stones with the African drummers play Sympathy for the Devil, she is reborn. In Kensington Market, amid joustings and Afghan folks, Che Guevara posters, mandolins, tie-dye shirts and kaftans, she finds a white angora hooded dress and marries the boy who shares her baby. A boy not overburdened with piety, who plays guitar and sings to her in her bedsit before Stephen's present. She loves the sacredness of their anonymity, their togetherness, and that year, as her belly swells, she feels the walls of her prison fade and vows her baby freedom. She remembers walking in single file and silence above the convent chapel, the wars waged by mind and body, by saint and woman. She wonders how the nuns shaped those battles. There are battles too. She thinks too of the treks in the rhododendron woods and secrets whispered among the girls, and wonders how her son coped with the burden of his enforced freedom. And my next poem tonight, I don't know if anybody has been to Oney Island near Clifton. And it's an amazing place. But once a year, when the tide goes out between Plaided Duff and Omi, this the horse, some horse races, and it's the most magical experience. So I went there last year with a couple of people, and it rained, so it was like being in this sort of pocket of water under the sea and just watching this fantastic thing happen. So I was kind of inspired to write this poem. It's called "On the Island Races 2015. At 10:30 the tide draws back to reveal the strand. The young men of Omi hammer stakes to hold the ropes that mark the track. 1 p.m. the carnival begins. Chips and tea vans, ice cream and burgers, swing boats, chair planes, beach buggies, horse boxes, and the tote have settled in, cars semi-circling the track. Old nags and novices, horses and ponies parade before the stage, puncture-sized form. The race begin. Connemara ponies through the mist spray at their heels the plop of hooves on the sea-shaped sand, echo warriors from the port of Manon and Montclair. A seagull watches as they take the turn at Cadadoc onto the strait towards Omi. Sinead Logan, on Dancing in the Dark, gallops home to win the plate. Men wild for triumph beat the air, gather their winnings, and children in shiny coats and wellies squeal their delight in the rain. By 5 is over. The grey waters close in, Omi once again cut off. The strait, silent, except for the lapping waves and the curlew call. And my next poem I read last week at a Hiroshima Day. It's a day to commemorate Hiroshima and a peace day. So I read, because sometimes I write political poems. And it's called "Does It Matter?" And it's after Siegfried Sassoon, who was a poet after the First World War. And he was a great advocate, enthusiast of the war before he went there. Afterwards, he saw the horrors and wrote a lot about it. So called, "Does It Matter?" Does the woman whose two children died from a direct airstrike on Baghdad say it doesn't matter, it's just war collateral? Does a small boy washed up on the green shore think, on the Greek shore think, I'm just war collateral? What do the nurses in the ruined hospital of Aleppo feel as they watch their patients die? Do those blind from Agent Orange begging on the streets of Saigon say, we're just war collateral? Do the ghosts of Hiroshima, whose bodies singed to shadows, cry, we're just war collateral? Does it matter that in Calais, an engineer and a doctor from Kabul sewed their lips together to highlight the horror of refugee camps? Does it matter that no TV station covered their story? Does it matter that we, the island of saints and scholars, while declaiming our neutrality, join the battle groups of Europe? Does it matter that warplanes with troops and arms and stolen people land and refuel in Shannon? Does it matter that we, sanctimonious in our neutrality, make parts for war? Does it matter that we in the land of freedom imprison protesters? Does it matter that we in the island of 1,000 welcomes only welcome those who pay? Does it matter that we, the lovely people, the well-behaved drunks who help old ladies across roads and sing lullabies to babies, lock our borders to those dispossessed by war and call them terrorists? And I'm going to move on to something a little bit lighter and my... This is about the Guillemots, and they're a husband and wife, and they have a sort of rather acrimonious relationship. And sorry for this. Yeah. And this particular episode happened on Christmas Eve. Called Christmas Eve with Mr. and Mrs. Guillemot.
Why did you buy me a book on Taliban art?
I thought you'd be interested.
Why would I be interested in Taliban art?
I just thought it was your kind of thing.
Why would it be my kind of thing?
It just seemed to fit.
Is it because of how they treat their women?
Well, that actually hadn't occurred to me, but now that you say it.
As you know, I have a lot of women friends, and I have great respect for them.
That's nice to know.
What are you at? You're so friggin' jealous and manipulative. You use every opportunity to undermine me.
I don't have to. You do terribly well yourself.
Would you ever get off your self-righteous podium and take a good look at yourself?
Because I'm not wallowing in the gutter, I'm on a righteous podium. Interesting. I suppose I should neglect the children and go on the drink myself.
You drive any man to drink with your supercilious shite.
So now it's my fault. You're a pathetic cliché.
You never fucking let up, do you? Even on Christmas Eve.
That language is hardly appropriate to the festive season.
So now this is about manners.
Some appreciation of a rare book might be in order.
Do you ever go and fuck yourself?
I might indeed, that would be preferable. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Skinny-Watt weren't having a great time together, as you can see, so they decided to take a holiday and go to Kandao Island in the South China Sea. So one evening, Mrs. Skinny-Watt is watching the sunset. How beautiful to see the sun fall into the V of the mountains, sprinkle pink mist into its folds, shape its contour to its dusty night, mysterious, grainy, like an old photo.
That's not a proper sunset. It's too high behind the hills.
It is beautiful. See the sea foam sparkle on the amber waves. The beehive islands fade into the purple horizon, disappearing into night.
Sunsets need to be viewed from the west. In Galway, the sun lights the sea in a blaze of red before sinking beyond the horizon. Now that's a proper sunset.
Why can you not be here now, present to this sunset, to the beauty of this moment, mindful?
I am present here. Just think, I've seen better sunsets.
Why do you need to compare it?
Can a man not have an opinion without having it analysed to death?
Oh, for heaven's sake. Mr. and Mrs. Gillick-Mott were interviewed about their idea of a soulmate. I don't ask for red roses. It would be far more imaginative than that. Lunch in a wild flower meadow on Inishman, his chi flowing like a mountain torrent, yet he's in control of his inner Neanderthal. He's heroic yet gentle, daring yet attentive. His only quest to kindle the green light of love in my eyes. He'd be eloquent but not effusive. Never interprets an invitation to chat as a call to war. He's no need to strut, to run with the pack. He's got it all. He's searched for the key to the shutters of my wounded heart and won.
Soulmate, I'm not fussy. I like the good of it. Don't mind a bit of highbrow. You know, poetry, spirituality, that sort of thing. It feels good, like, to be punching above your weight. It keeps the lads guessing. I like them tidy, not obsessive, and I'd help out, of course. I don't need a ganger, and if I say I'll do it, then I'll do it. I'm a simple man.
Sure. Our next piece happened in 2015. And Mrs. There was a lot of talk about 2016 and the commemoration service of Easter 2016. And Mrs. Guillemot wanted to, you know, participate in it in some sort of a way. So she thought that maybe her car would, you know, could be involved in some way. I'd like my car to die on Easter Sunday 2016. A gentle implosion, a noble death to commemorate our heroes who sacrificed their lives for their country.
Car's a heap of shite. The clutch is slipping and the starter's almost gone, and it won't last the year without shoving money into it.
My car was born in 1996, like 1916, an auspicious seven, representing the mystic underworld. MacDonald's house had seven doors that led to seven paths, which held seven quarters filled with sacrificial boar.
What's with the seven? Yours is only three doors. Okay, it smells like an abattoir.
Don't need your slide remarks. I would like to celebrate their vision, the altruism, the generosity of those men who died for our freedom.
What freedom?
They created a country rooted in the mists of antiquity, yet modern, reborn into its own unique nationhood.
Yeah, cheaply sold to the highest bidder.
What is wrong with you? These great men, romantic men like Joseph Mary Plunkett, who in his prison cell placed a wedding ring on Grace's finger hours before his execution.
Lucky bastard. He got off like it.
You are so vulgar, so insensitive. Their love is profound, born of the deep, spiritual connectedness that transcends the confines of time, made eternal in one perfect moment.
With the priest watching out.
You understand absolutely nothing of real passion, of love, of sacrifice. You just wallow in base desire.
So now you want me to take a bullet to prove my love?
All I am saying is I want to make a simple gesture that honours heroism. I'd like my car's demise to empathise in some symbolic way with those great men.
You're saying you want to blow up your car and associate the death of a piece of consumerist junk with the sacrifice those men and women made?
God's sake.
I've had an epiphany. At the traffic lights near Aldi on the way to get some cans. And a car was struck by a blinding light, brighter than gamma ray bursts. Don't know if it was the slant of the sun or the traffic lights changing amber, reflecting on the mirror or an oncoming car. I heard a voice say, "Mr. Guillemot, Mr. Guillemot, why do you persecute me?" "Who are you?" I asked, not recognizing the husky voice. "I am the transcendent spirit of your wife whom you torment constantly." I felt the hands tremble, almost crashed into the oncoming white Hyatt. "Go home! Stop thinking of your next quip! Focus on her words! Listen to her wisdom!" It terrified me. As you know, I'm not a man easily frightened. So now, on my knees, I'm begging your forgiveness.
God's sake, are you on something?
Nothing. I realised in that moment I'd been a zealot for machismo, afraid of becoming a henpeck wimp. The gloves always on, never listening.
Well, that's true.
I know. You've studied, reflected, meditated, pondered meanings, read poetry, self-help books, workshops, watched subtitled films. I have resisted your wisdom, thinking it's a prattle of the self-obsessed. All the while wallowing in my immediate gratification, as you said only last week in my base desires, if you'll be my guide, my guru, I'll be your slave.
You move very well I'm not into that sort of thing.
I know you're not perfect, and you don't need to be.
What do you mean I'm not perfect? Are you saying that there's something wrong with me? Is this just another of your devious ploys to undermine me?
No, I didn't mean that. It's just sometimes, you know the way you go on.
Just because I am articulate, sensitive, and express myself in a manner other than grunting does not mean that I go on and on.
No, of course not. I was just saying that I need to listen to you more. From now on, I will dedicate myself totally and completely to your every word. I need to learn your respect. I need your love.
Would you ever get up off the floor? It's very disturbing.
No, I need your forgiveness. I'm a chastened man, a humbled man.
Would you like me to call the doctor?
No, I've had an epiphany.
Are you sure you haven't taken a knee or mush or something?
No, no. I've written a little love poem to my dear wife.
A love poem you've written, is it?
Yes, this poem. To my dear wife. The swans glide in a cacophony of silence, rustling wing feathers their soulful melodies. I watched their dreams entwined, remembering that summer's day on Grattan Beach, when sand and sea united in homage to our mellifluous love. How sad too that Bammy Down, you in your caftan and clogs, me an awkward long-haired youth, the rising sun wallpapering our passion in blue and camel clouds and silver sea. I watched their stillness, no words, no shards of steel to pierce that armored heart, only the purity of their love.
I just have to say this. The sentiment is touching, but do you need a soulful cacophony of mellifluous charred hearts compared to the summer's day? Really?
Sorry, just like the words, I saw them in a poem and I wanted to express my feelings.
The poem. The poem was advising against their use. Real poets distance themselves from cliche over a superfluous use of words. Use the vernacular. It's much more contemporary. Be less sentimental. It's a bit cloying.
Okay, maybe you're right. How about this? Saw a brace of new swans down by the cladder. Great their silence. He doesn't have to listen to her nagging.